From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The new film, 12 Years a Slave, is based on a true story, a harrowing one, about a black man born free, living free, who is kidnapped and sold into slavery. He must then live or survive within that brutal institution. American slavery has been shown in film for generations, but the way the country sees slavery, the way filmmakers tell the story of slavery, has changed. Now the gloss is entirely gone. This hour on Point, 12 Years a Slave and American Slavery in Film Through the Years. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Which films about slavery, depictions of slavery, have stuck with you? Has Hollywood helped us see it or helped us pretend? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Wesley Morris. He was a longtime film critic for the Boston Globe, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism in 2012. He now covers sports and popular culture for the website Grantland. Wesley Morris, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here today.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
And with us from Los Angeles is Brenda Stevenson, professor of history at UCLA, a scholar of American slave history, author of Life in Black and White Family and Community in the Slave South. Brenda Stevenson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
Listen, we initially visualized this before any of us had seen the film. We'd only read reviews. It's all about this and other American films, and I do want to do that. But I saw 12 Years a Slave just last night. I have to say it was so, I thought it was a great film. I found it so sobering that part of me doesn't even want to look at other films, just wants to talk about this. But we'll look at both. We'll look at the history. We'll look at the film history and what it says about how we've treated and framed slavery. Wesley, here you are, you and Brenda, African-American viewers both. How did you see this film? It's hard for me even to imagine watching it from those shoes. It was hard enough for my white shoes, Wesley.
Well, I think the achievement of the movie is that the achievement of most of these movies when they work, any movie that depicts any sort of racial injustice in which white people suffer or black people suffer at the hands of white people, be it an institution like slavery or something like the LAPD. I think that it's incumbent upon the film to sort of leave an entire audience shaken and disturbed. And I think in this case, for me, in the case of 12 Years a Slave, it is a hard movie to watch, but it is also it's also an important movie to watch because it's showing you something that the movies have gone out of their way to keep from an audience. I mean, you'd get slight depictions of what life was like on plantations and for slaves. And just even getting 2 hours or so of that in this film, it's the beginning of a kind of corrective that the movies haven't really tried to reckon with in the way that this particular film does. And there are a couple other examples of that, and we can talk about those.
Yeah.
But this is obviously the most blatant one, and it's also one of the very, very few directed by a black man, a guy named Steve McQueen, who's an Englishman.
Mm-hmm. And written by, that is the
And written by John Ridley.
By another black man, John Ridley.
Yep.
I mean, Brenda Stevenson, you saw this. Steve McQueen has said that he made this film, he said, because I wanted to visualize a time in history that hadn't been visualized that way. He said, I feel sometimes people take slavery very lightly, to be honest. Is there truth in that, Brenda? I mean, even after Roots and all the rest, we can look back and see a time when there was almost a shameful romance put around slavery by Hollywood. Have we still taken it too lightly, even up until this day, 2013, when 12 Years a Slave shows up, Brenda?
I think that the nation has tried to forget that part of its history. We tend, as a nation, to think about the wonderful things in American history and to shy away from knowing about the shameful things in American history. So I think that with regard to the way in which the public thinks about slavery and sees slavery, that they think about it as something that happened a long time ago, and that's something that's been corrected, you know, through the Constitution, the constitutional amendments, the Civil Rights Movement, et cetera, et cetera. I think the film is a wonderful film depicting slavery. I think he does a very good job in the depiction of the violence of slavery and the abuse of slavery, and how everyone touched by it is deeply touched by it. I think there were a few other films that also spoke to the violence and how harrowing an experience it was for everyone involved in it emotionally, physically, you know, psychologically, sexually as well. Looking at the film myself, I worked with this document, and so I was pleased that they stuck to a great deal of what Solomon Northrup actually wrote. I am from the South myself. I grew up with the stories of slavery, my mother's stories of the African girl sold from Virginia to South Carolina and sexually abused, had three children by her master, and my great-grandfather talking about how he'd have to wash his mother down with salt water after she was whipped because she wouldn't have sex with her father, with his father. So this resonated very deeply for me.
Brenda, how do you watch a film like this? And we'll talk about the detail of it. I want to go to the history. It's an amazing historical story, the document, you say, the book that this man wrote once he finally got away from that slavery. But I found it almost unbearable watching it as a white American, as an African American. Maybe you're inoculated already. Maybe you know enough of this history. But did you walk out of there in a rage, or are you so deep in this that you just understand it as more telling?
Well, it was very difficult to watch, although I knew the narrative, and I know all the other stories that speak to the reality of that narrative. I prepared myself for it. I reread the narrative before I went to see it so that I knew what was coming around the corner. And so that helped me greatly to sit through the film. But, you know, some of it is just so brutal and so realistically brutal that it was very, very difficult.
You saw it at a BET screening, Black Entertainment Television. That means with a lot of African Americans. I mean, I saw it alone in a great big theater last night. They screened it for us. But in that setting, what was the social reaction in the setting in which you saw 12 Years a Slave, Brenda?
Where people were, I think, both taken to the depths, as well as at the end, they felt great relief and joy that he had escaped. But of course, you have to remember those who were left behind, those persons on Edwin Epps' plantation who did not escape. So I actually, after I left, I went back to check the census records for Edwin Epps to see who these people were.
Louisiana plantation man depicted here by Fassbender is just a tortured nut.
He's crazy. He really is. He's a sadist. But he did exist, and he did have 8 slaves on his plantation in 1850, of which one was Solomon Northrup. The interesting thing about them that we don't get in the film is that everyone except for Solomon came from a plantation in South Carolina. So they had these familial and community bonds, and he sort of came in really as an outsider, and that's something that we don't particularly get, but we do sort of understand how they survived because they had that tie that was generations old.
Wesley, I mean, we'll look at the depictions. We'll look at it compared to others. We'll look at what Steve McQueen's up to here. But how do you handle your emotions coming out of a film like this?
I sat there when it was over. I usually stay for the closing credits, but in this case, I just didn't want to look at anybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to say anything. And I tend to be like that when I leave a movie. But this was one of those things where I wasn't even avoiding seeing anyone to share my opinion. I just didn't have anything to say. It's a movie that it's in some ways quite clinical. There's a distance that it has. It's not quite objective. I mean, it's what it's giving you is not quite objectivity. There's a degree of subjectivity here. You're watching most of this proceed from the point of view of one character. But what it manages to do that I think is very important is to not melodramatize the circumstances, but to give you what it does is more devastating. It's explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
It has characters. The opening scene looks like a scene of possible rebellion. The opening shot is eight or ten
group slaves,
of black men, mm-hmm, standing, facing, just looking slightly beyond the camera,
mm-hmm,
and you think something is about to happen. There's a magisterialness about that shot, but there also is something you feel. I don't know. I was braced for something else to happen, and then there's a cut to an overseer explaining how these guys are going to go in and cut the cane, which is what they do.
Yeah.
And the movie sort of proceeds just like that. Just the cost of not picking enough cotton is being beaten every day you fail to pick a satisfactory, mm-hmm, amount of cotton.
Moment, the specter of violence, the threat of violence hanging over every moment, even the most casual walk across the lawn.
Right. Well, I mean, there is that amazing scene that, you know, Brenda can talk about how frequently it happened. But there's a scene in which Solomon is hung for punishment, basically, because he talks back to one of the overseers.
Hung by the neck, on his tiptoes, under the tree, in the mud, in the heat. Those
and
toes aren't extended,
for,
and he's dead.
For what must be days.
Seen from Roots behind us, we will compare and contrast. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about slavery in American film, and the latest to go there, very powerfully, brutally, but in its own way, majestically, it is the new 12 Years a Slave. Brenda Stevenson is with us, professor of history. She studied American slavery a lot at UCLA, author of Life in Black and White, Family and Community in the Slave South. She's looked particularly at women in slavery, and we will look at that. Wesley Morris is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic for the Boston Globe, now at Grantland. He joins us today from New York. Of course, 12 Years a Slave comes from history, a man who was snatched away on a trip to Washington, D.C., sold into slavery in the South. Here's a scene from the new film. That was back in 1841 when that happened. In the new film, Solomon Northup, historical character played here by Chiwetel Ejiofor, tells a fellow slave, Eliza, played by Udipero Uduye, that he will not wallow in sorrow because he's now a slave.
I will not fall into despair. I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
Oh, Ford is your opportunity? You think he does not know that you are more than you suggest, but he does nothing for you, nothing. You are no better than prized livestock. Call for him. Call, tell him of your previous circumstances and see what it earns you, Solomon.
He does not want to believe it. This free man, well into his what looks like very comfortable adult life in Saratoga, New York, now a slave in just terrible conditions in Louisiana, gets moved from plantation to plantation, learns he has to hide all of his education, his reading and writing and learned background. Here, a mistress on the Epps plantation, the mistress questions him closely about what he knows and warns him of a kind of punishment that's hardly unusual in this film.
Who were your master?
Master name of Freeman.
Was he a learned man?
I suppose so.
He learned you to read?
A word, here or there. But I've no understanding of the written text.
Don't trouble yourself with it. Same as the rest, Master brought you here to work, that's all. Any more, I'll earn you 100 lashes.
And there are lashes aplenty in 12 Years a Slave. Brenda Stevenson, you've read the book, you've seen the film. Remind us of the history here, the story that's depicted in this movie.
Well, this is the story of Solomon, as you said, who was a very intelligent man. He was literate. He was an inventor. He was a musician. He was a skilled craftsman, and he was married. He had three children. Mm-hmm. And he goes off to find work. He's duped into believing that he is going to perform as a musician for a circus. And he goes very foolishly into slave territory.
His wife is away
Washington,
with the kids for temporary work, doing some cooking someplace, and he thinks he can pick up a little extra money while she's gone, the film depicts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he goes into, as I said, slave territory in Washington, D.C., and he ends up in a slave pen and sold from there to, taken from there to Norfolk, Virginia, where he's then placed on another ship and taken to New Orleans, which is the major port for the domestic slave trade during this time period. And he's sold to Louisiana and to work cotton and also sugar. Louisiana, if you will recall, was actually the frontier along with Texas at that time. And so it's very rough going for anyone who is involved in this very labor intensive and, as we saw, very violent environment. And he stays there for 12 years. An interesting thing that may have been may have not picked up in the movie because there's so much going on is that Solomon actually is the overseer for Epps for 8 years. And so some of his abilities are put to use by Epps there. And so it's also through the lens of the overseer that he brings judgment to the people around him.
That's interesting. There's a hint of that because his skills are there, his intelligence is there. Epps wants to put it to work, but that very same intelligence is always, there's the danger of it coming back to bite him in a terrible way. Wesley Moore's one thing that just hit me here is that step from freedom, he's a free man, into chains, the infinite distance that one falls in that moment and how he's instantly subject to the most perverse human whims as soon as that freedom is gone, Wesley.
No, it's like the Twilight Zone. it's real. And I think that there's an amazing moment that happens during one of the flashbacks during the sequence while Solomon during that series of sequences in which Solomon is trying to process what exactly led to this. Yeah. And one of the things that the movie shows you is the scene in which he goes with his family in New York. He goes into a store one day to buy some things before his wife goes on her trip. And they're walking across Main Street and there's a slave who catches sight of Solomon and his family.
Yeah.
And he can't believe it. He just is dumbstruck with shock
at a free black man in this country.
Well, and not only is he free, but he's
well dressed.
He seems to be completely
.
I mean, he's a middle class free person, and he wanders into the store and the Northups go into the store, and then this man follows them in, and he just gapes at them. He can't help it. He's in shock, and you know, the guy's master comes in and says, "What are you doing in here?" And he removes him from the store. But Solomon, or the movie from Solomon's perspective, is remembering this scene and the sort of terrible irony that I don't think Solomon thought anything or didn't think much of it at the time, but now realizes that, you know, he's in apparently far worse straits than that slave he saw up in New York.
I want to try and begin to get a sense of where we've gone in these depictions. Steve McQueen, director of this film, essentially says, you Americans have been sugarcoating and lying to yourselves, and you know, I had to come along and do something about it, and he has done something here. And yet it hasn't all been moonlight and magnolias. Here's from way back, 36 years ago now, for 8 consecutive nights on ABC, the miniseries Roots aired. Incredible Nielsen ratings. Final episode still standing as one of the highest rated U.S. TV shows ever. Here's the scene from Roots where Kunta Kinte, played by LeVar Burton, has been brought back to the plantation after trying to escape. The overseer, played by Vic Morrow, has him strung up, whipped until he accepts his slave name. The other voice you'll hear here is Louis Gossett Jr. playing Fiddler, who watches this whipping in Roots in horror.
I want to hear you say your name. Your name is Toby. What's your name?
Kunta. Lord God help that boy. They're gonna whip him dead.
What's your name? Say it. Toby.
There, from Roots, and It Is Not Pretty. That's 36 years ago now. Opening this weekend and next in cities across the country, 12 Years a Slave. And here's an interaction in this case where Solomon Northup, who has been snatched, kidnapped, sold into slavery, is on the plantation, and the carpenter, one of his masters there, doesn't like the intelligence he's bringing to what he's doing. And here's a confrontation in 12 Years a Slave.
I thought I told you to commence to putting on clappers.
Yes, master, I'm about it. These have all been replaced.
Well, and didn't I tell you to get a keg of nails?
And so I did.
So you did. God damn you. I thought you knowed something.
I did as instructed. If there's something wrong, it's wrong with the instruction.
Black bastard. You, goddamn, black bastard, strip your clothes. Strip.
I will not.
This scene ends very badly for Solomon Northup, to the hung from a tree for many hours, maybe days, that Wesley Morris talks about. Wesley, look at Roots. Look at 12 Years a Slave there. It wasn't pretty in Roots. This wasn't Moonlight and Magnolias. This was a whipping, and yet there's something different in 12 Years a Slave.
Well, it doesn't seek to reconcile anything, and I think that was I think that part of the reason that last episode of Roots was the most highly rated episode of the eight was because there was the actual eventness of it, and it's really hard to sort of overplay what an event that movie was. I mean, I'm sure Brenda remembers just I have vague memories of this. I was two when it happened, but. It just the event of everybody still talked about it when I was a kid, just like everybody getting together and watching this show. And that eighth episode was the one in which all the reconciliation happens, and everybody wanted to see the forgiveness and the redemption and the apology. Would, you know, what would happen? Would, you know, would he get the whipping or would he not get the whipping? Mm-hmm. Over those eight nights, I think what you got was something that manages to be even-handed. It's not quite the right word because there's no real apology for slavery, and yet what you get is a full sense of this, both the system and the people, the white people and black people within that system, and how that ecosystem functioned. And I think what the McQueen film does is it removes any possibility of reconciliation. It's not a film that wants to make you feel good about something that there's no way to feel good about, which is what the slavery legacy in the movies is. It either ignores it, or the movies have found a way to uplift people, because Hollywood is run predominantly by white people, and a lot of those people are liberals, and a lot of the guilt that drives the production of these movies and the stories they tell is that the only way Hollywood really has, the most powerful way it has to say collectively that it's sorry. So this is how you get all these films about white people fighting for and arguing over the liberation of blacks.
I mean, Brad Pitt,
whether it's slavery or beyond.
Yeah, Brad Pitt, one of the producers of this film, shows up as the kind of unlikely, I guess, traveling Canadian carpenter who eventually turns the key that gets Solomon Northup out of here, but it's a long, bloody road before then. The whipping kind of never ends. Manola Dargis writes in the New York Times, the headline was "The Blood and Tears, Not the Magnolias." She writes, 12 Years a Slave isn't the first movie about slavery in the United States, but it may be the one that finally makes it impossible for American cinema to continue to sell the ugly lies it's been hawking for more than a century. David Denby in The New Yorker says, 12 Years a Slave is easily the greatest feature film ever made about American slavery. It shows up. The plantation scenes have gone with the wind for the sentimental kitsch that they are, as if we didn't know. And intentionally or not, it's an artist's rebuke to Quentin Tarantino's high-pitched, luridly extravagant Django Unchained. I want to go back to that kind of depiction in Gone with the Wind, 1939. Mammy, played by Hattie McDaniel, helps Scarlett, played by Vivian Leigh, prepare for a party next door at 12 Oaks Plantation, upset about Scarlett's low-cut dress.
Ooh! Just hold on and suck in.
Mommy, here's the scarlet victuals.
You can take it all back to the kitchen. I won't need to buy it.
Oh, yes, and you is. You's going to eat every mouthful of this.
I'm not.
We'll put on the dress, because we're late already.
What my lamb going to wear?
That.
No, you ain't. You can't show your bosom for 3 o'clock. I'm going to speak to your ma about you.
If you say one word, Mother, I won't need to buy it.
All jaunty music and Mammy pulling faces in Gone with the Wind. I mean, Brenda Stevenson, it is just light years from that to 12 Years a Slave.
Yes, it certainly is. And that image of Mammy, of course, is one of the most beloved in terms of the history of the United States, although it's very false in this particular film. I do think that Steve McQueen does an excellent job in portraying the relationship between slave women and their slave mistresses. There is no romanticism there, and it indicates in his film the kind of investment that slaveholding women also had in their slave property and this sense of racial superiority vis-a-vis their slaves, mm-hmm. and how also they contributed to the violence of the plantation.
Well, they were threatened. Their men were taking these African American, these slave women, and it was, at least in this film, a vivid threat to the lady of the house, the plantation madam.
Well, it's a threat to her pride.
Yes.
Clearly, her husband is sadistic, and he is not in love with either his wife or with Patsy, mm-hmm. but he wants to control both of them. And she is embarrassed by his obsession with Patsy, and it causes her to become obsessed as well. And we do see this playing out over and over and over again on the plantation, and this is well documented in the accounts given by slave women and slave men, as well as in the divorce petitions of slaveholding women.
Let me just begin to bring our listeners in. Tina in Sunderland, Vermont, thank you for calling, Tina. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I really, really want to see this movie because I never, ever want to get comfortable. I want to stay disturbed. I am an African-American woman. I have a biracial son. He's 5 now. I have been debating, you know, what do I show him? You know, I want him to know the truth, but I don't, how do I have him, you know, relate to one side or the other?
Don't show him this one for a while, Tina. Show him one day, but not for a while.
But not even one day. You know, how do you grow, you know, graduate to that level? You know, I don't want him to feel like, you know, the black side of his heritage was, you know, anything to be embarrassed about. Or the white side. It's very disturbing. I want to remain disturbed because slavery hasn't ended. And we're kidding ourselves if we think it has.
There's a projection right there. Steve McQueen said something like that himself. The director said, you know, you walk out of the cinema, I'm reading him saying, the story continues, evidence of slavery as you walk down the street. And he says in prison populations and poverty and education issues in this state, I guess, Wesley, that Tina can pretty much count on remaining disturbed seeing 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a parent, but I definitely don't think I would take a child to see this movie at all. There are some things that are good training wheel movies if she wants some of those. I mean, it's not, I mean, I saw Roots when I was older than 5. I was a couple years older than that, but it was rebroadcast and I watched it during one of those rebroadcasts.
Mm-hmm. Watch out even there. 5 too young, much older for this one, but it tells a lot of truth. 12 Years a Slave is the latest. Wesley Morris is with us. Brenda Stevenson is here from Los Angeles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about slavery in American film, and the latest film to go there very powerfully, it is the new 12 Years a Slave, opening this coming weekend in some cities and the week after, November 1st, and many more around the country, directed by British director Steve McQueen. Wesley Morris is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning movie critic for the Boston Globe, now at Grantland, writes on sports and popular culture there. Brenda Stevenson is with us, professor of history at UCLA, author of Life in Black and White, Family and Community in the Slave South. She knows this terrain very well. Here's a scene in 12 Years a Slave where the slave Patsy, played by Lupita Nyong'o, explains to her master, the crazed Edwin Epps, played by Michael Fassbender, that she went to another plantation to get soap, but she will soon be strung to the whipping post, and it's bad.
I went to Master Shaw's plantation.
You admit it?
Yes, freely. And you know why? I got this from Mrs. Shaw. Mrs. Epps won't even grant me no soap to clean with. I stink so much I make myself gag. 500 pounds of cotton, day in, day out, more than any man here. And for that, I will be clean.
She is his champion, cotton picker at 500 pounds plus every time she's in the field, way more than anybody else. She is also his sexual interest, repeatedly raped. The implication, Brenda, in this movie is that slave females were essentially concubines for the taking at any time. What about that depiction?
That is a very accurate depiction. Slave girls and women were routinely sexually harassed and or raped at some point in their lives. And that is really one of the things outside of the rape of Kizzy and Roots that we don't see very much in films about slavery. When we do see it, we see, you know, the concubine, the Mrs. Shaw, for example, the Mistress Shaw. But the brutality of the sexual abuse was palpable. It just, everyone went through it, and it was something that was to break the slave woman as well as to sexually satisfy the slave owner.
Wesley, one of our listeners, Alvin, writes to us online, says, funny that we have to have a Brit illustrate an American account of slavery that's been sitting on library shelves for over a century. Alvin writes to us, where was Spike Lee on this one? Too busy trying to make it? Where was Steven Spielberg? Can't risk a little of that Hollywood power he has that allows him to make anything he wants? I mean, Steve McQueen has said on this front himself, he said, the only thing you can say about it is, why was this book lost in America? The actual director, Steve McQueen, says, good question, Wesley, why?
Well, I mean, I can't speak on the Spike Lee front. I mean, I think Spike Lee's goals as a filmmaker are to try to make other movies, tell other stories about black life in America. And I think that, you know, this idea of slavery being ground zero for how black people tell stories about themselves is a very interesting one, but it is not the only story that a black filmmaker could tell. And I think that you'd have to have a story that would interest you enough to want to do it. I mean, I'm not speaking or defending Spike Lee, but I would say that on the other side of that, the Steven Spielberg question, I think that this 12 Years a Slave is the antidote to the Steven Spielberg problem, which is not so much a problem movie to movie, but I mean the general Hollywood problem of how of representation and who gets to tell stories, and when they tell the story, what is the story about? And having a movie in which there's no way out for a white audience, there's no one for a white audience to identify racially, which has always seemed to me to be a reductive way to sort of sell a movie. Like a black audience needs a black way in, and a white audience needs a white way in.
Yeah.
We're all people to some extent, but I think that at some point you begin to notice the imbalances in terms of who these stories are about and who's telling these stories. And in this case, I think it's very powerful to have a story about a black man and black people experience slavery at the hands of white people who are completely amoral about what is inarguably immoral.
Inarguably. No question about it. If I may, Brenda, let me bring a caller or two in here. Matthew in Plattsburgh, New York. Matthew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was just wondering, I've only seen a smattering of slavery movies, but one that really hit home was Glory, And one scene in particular when this is, again, the movie about the first all-black regiment to fight in the Civil War. So in some sense, there's some comparisons that could be made because here these men are free, fighting for freedom, supposedly, but there's a point at which one of the characters portrayed by Denzel Washington misbehaves, and the captain of the regiment strips off his shirt to punish him by way of whipping him, and they see all the scars on his back from his slavery days when he was a former slave. And I just wondered if you're familiar with that scene and what your thoughts are in terms of that movie's portrayal of the topic, and if that helped to educate your portrayal in your movie.
Of course, in Stephen Queen's movie, of course, Glory, Denzel Washington, is tangential in a way, but you're right. There's the scene where we see the whip marks on his back. Here's just a bit from that Oscar, a Golden Globe winning 1989 Glory. Here's a bit where the Sergeant Major McClehy, played by John Finn, trains the first all-black volunteer Massachusetts Infantry Regiment. He's shocked to learn here that the troops lack basic education.
Company! Halt! For God's sake, man, do you not know your right from your left?
No, sir.
How many here do not know right from left?
Jesus, a pity.
This is your front. This is your rear. This is your right. And this... Now you're learning, boyo.
But there is so much that those who were in the slave system do know. What about Glory, Wesley, and its depiction?
I mean, it's an important movie, and I think at the time it was important. I think you were seeing not only in Denzel Washington's character a runaway slave fighting for the United States, but you were also seeing him fight among his other black men. But of course, the problem with that movie is the thing that I've been talking about, which is that it can't happen without the Matthew Broderick character. I mean, as a production, it can't happen without the Matthew Broderick
character. Well, and the white man is at the heart of the story still.
Right, yes. And so that is, I mean, that's still a lingering problem, and it continues to be a problem, and one that is very much obviously on this movie's mind. I was curious about what Professor Stevenson was going to say about the questions we were talking about before with Spike Lee and Steven Spielberg.
Yes,
and those
please.
Movies.
Brenda Stevenson. Sorry. Yes, please, Brenda.
Well, I was going to say that I think certainly you do find in the Spielberg film Amistad that, again, that white men are at the center of it to a certain extent. But there is no more searing, I think, a visual account of Middle Passage than you find in Amistad. I looked at the film again last night, and I couldn't even watch all of that, of that scene. And with regard to Solomon Northrup's account and why it was left on the shelves for so long, I think people have to understand that there are literally hundreds of published accounts similar to his. And it is a rich account, but it is certainly not the only account that we have of slavery that really exposes it for the violent system that it was.
I mean, the psychological violence I found overwhelming, Brenda, the way that the most unimaginable tortures could just be produced at any time. And yes, you had moments where people were at last not working and maybe lounging or chatting, but it could just all be exploded in an instant when the overseer or the master or just about anybody who's white comes on the scene and takes offense or umbrage or just has a whim, Brenda.
Well, that certainly is true. Absolutely so. This was one of the things that was so devastating psychologically and frightening to enslaved people is that they never could predict, or it was rare for them to be able to predict, when violence would occur. And I think it's very interesting that Director McQueen speaks to this, the institution in the United States and how it's been sort of sugarcoated, which definitely is true. But of course, it's an institution institution that was throughout the Caribbean and mm-hmm. throughout South America as yes. well, and the brutality of life in the Caribbean and in South America was perhaps even more so than it was in the United States, where slaves only lived for 7 years on average once they reached prime status, and they never reproduced families whatsoever. So
in the Caribbean, you're saying they only lived 7 years on average?
In the Caribbean,
wow.
And in Brazil, where sugar was, of course, the crop, and we see sugar also mm-hmm. In Louisiana. But the United States has a horrible, violent regime of slavery. But within that horrible state as well, families were produced, slaves were able to form themselves in communities, and the life of the mortality was a little bit less. And so it's a lot that we have to learn about slavery. We're part of an entire system, and this film certainly does illustrate some of the horrors of the system.
How was it that there was no reproduction in the Latin American slave world? How could that be? Why not?
Because they only wanted slave men, and so they imported, 2/3 of the people they imported were men, and they continued to import slaves, if you're looking at Cuba, Brazil, into the 1870s, into the 1880s. And so there was no way for people to form themselves into families. And, of course, again, the mortality rates were very high, and infant mortality was extremely high as well.
Wesley, I mean, the white characters in this film, in the South, torn themselves. They, you've got Cumberbatch in here as the Master Ford, and he has some ambivalence about the violence, but he's got economic interests that he's going to put first. He's not going to lose the mortgage on his plantation. You've got Fassbender's character who, some describe him as having fallen in love with Patsy, but he can't stand the fact that he's fallen in love with his slave and therefore, you know, whips her nearly to death and more. All kinds of cross currents for the whites in this, though not excusing cross currents.
No, I mean it. You get a gamut. You get an unsympathetic gamut of types of people, and it's interesting because I think that one Master Ford, the plantation owner played by Benedict Cumberbatch, is interesting because you, in a different movie, in a different movie that has a different agenda, you'd get a film in which he is depicted as the benevolent plantation
mm-hmm.
owner.
Yeah.
And the plantation owner who, you know, where all the slaves are treated well and everybody's happy and nothing bad ever happens. And I think he has a conscience, but his conscience, he can't afford to let that get the better of him because he's a businessman. And I think that is, I mean, everything that I've read about the procedural aspect of the way plantations function laid what was apparent to me at all times was the inherent tension between operating a business and suppressing your conscience. And just in the inherent right that one feels to be able to do this as an American citizen, that it's just the way it is, owning slaves.
It's my property, the Epps character, Fassbender, says. Let me get one more call, if I may, Wesley. Kelly in Nashville, Tennessee. Kelly, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I am a white Southerner. I grew up in rural Georgia and small towns in Georgia and Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up hearing stories of happy slaves and communities celebrating Gone with the Wind and how the Civil War wasn't really about slavery. And then I watched the Confederate flag reappear during the Civil Rights Movement. And it was all really shocking and kind of offensive to me, even as a white Southerner. And I really believe in my heart that we're never going to be able to move beyond the anger and division that we see in this country until we have a real honest dialogue and a truth-telling about what happened during that period. And I just really want to thank your guests for starting the dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly, for that call. I don't know where we stand in that dialogue, Brenda. How would you describe it?
Well, I think we're having dialogue now, and it sort of comes and goes. We saw a little bit of dialogue with Django, you know, last year, and, you know, with the Lincoln movie and Lincoln the Vampire Slayer and all of that. It's interesting that we actually have to have a film to have dialogue about this. I mean, I love film and I love to go see it and I always use it in my classes. But it's interesting that we have to actually have a film to talk about this really important and long term institution in our country. Our country was built economically on slavery. You know, all 13 colonies before the American Revolution had slaves. Slavery was the beginning of globalization, of economic globalization, of which we were part of as a colonial, you know, entity and all of that. And it was 250 years prior to emancipation. But still, we have to have a Hollywood film to talk about it. And I find that to be very interesting and more than a little bit disturbing.
I mean, yes, I take your point entirely. And yet, you see the film, Wesley, and you see why it's so hard to talk about. This is almost unspeakable. It's just profoundly difficult to acknowledge, Wesley.
Right. But I also want to say, though, that it's important. This movie is important for a number of reasons, and it's important from an industry standpoint because you'll see more stories like this if it's a hit, and it will be some kind of hit. But I think it's also important for white audiences to see this movie and not think of it as an indictment against white audiences. I think we've been trained to need a way in to have a white audience see itself as a hero, and I think that doesn't give people enough credit for just wanting to see good stories and important stories be told. And I think that is the beginning of this dialogue that people need to have. And people who would be predisposed not to have this conversation should be maybe backed into having it if they're obstructing progress.
Well, 12 Years a Slave, it is a deep moral and historical challenge. It will challenge anybody. It's a worthy challenge. Everybody should take it on. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us. Wesley Morris, thank you so much. And Brenda Stevenson at UCLA, thank you. Thank you to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.